Welcome to Allocation Disorder. I am Sam Staskel, joined as always by my good buddy and co-host, Paul Tenorio. Paul, we've got something to talk about today.
Yeah, you workshopped that joke before this and
really good.
I don't know if it landed or not. I don't know.
We'll see. I think when you add it all up, it's going to be a good show, regardless of whether or not that some joke worked. But, you know, you win some, you lose some.
You're an idiot.
Yeah, I am. Confirmed. However, as I was just hinting at, there was some significant news in American soccer over the weekend. It was announced by U.S. Soccer and Soccer United Marketing, which, for those of you who do not know, is the, what would you call it, a commercial arm of Major League Soccer?
Yeah, the commercial arm.
A commercial arm. Anyway, they package a lot of things. They basically serve as like an agency of sorts for MLS and its owners. They help the Mexican Federation set up the U.S. tour and all the friendlies that are played here. They help run Leagues Cup. They sell a lot of the sponsorship. They sell media rights. And for years and years and years, they sold the media rights and handled all of the sponsorship for U.S. soccer and the friendlies that they would play here in the U.S., World Cup qualifiers that they would play here in the U.S. for both the men and the women. And those rights on the media side would be baked in to MLS's TV deal. And it was announced over the weekend by both entities that that deal will no longer proceed. U.S. soccer is bringing its operations in-house, so some no longer has that property. And, you know, some is a major vehicle for revenue for MLS and its owners. So this has a pretty significant impact that's going to be felt kind of across the landscape. And Paul, you wrote a very nice story, very informative story on the subject. Spoke with MLS Commissioner Don Garber, who is the head of SUM as well, for the article. So tell us, why did this happen?
Well, I think this happened mainly because U.S. Soccer was ready to bring operations in-house. If you look at their hires in the C-suite of U.S. Soccer, both the CEO and the COO of U.S. Soccer have experience in this side of the business. They both come from a marketing, sales, commercial background. Both of them worked for Soccer United Marketing. And so they have the experience. David Wright worked for 15 years for SUM and played a role in the deal for U.S. Soccer. And clearly U.S. Soccer believes that by bringing the commercial department in-house, yes, you take on the expense of hiring out that department, but they believe that they will make more money by doing that than they will by farming it out to SUM. And I think also we have to recognize that there are pros and cons to this move, right? The pros are, like I just said, you know, obviously you think that you can do more and make more money. Con being you have all the outlay costs of hiring out this department. But a big part of it too.
Do it yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you've got all that work to do. They looked at that from the people I spoke to within U.S. Soccer, looked at it as a positive that they were going to be having these conversations with their partners. In today's world, the partners want more. It's not just you're a title sponsor and that's it. You know, there's ways to integrate those sponsors into kind of the things that U.S. Soccer is doing or whatever company it may be, into the content that's produced. And I think also we have to recognize when you are representing yourself, you are the top priority, right? When you're making those sales, when you're dealing with the partners, you know, Soccer United Marketing, yes, they represent or they have U.S. Soccer as a client, but they also have the FMF as a client. They have CONCACAF as a client. They have MLS as a client, and they're representing all of those clients to these potential
a lot of
partners.
Different accounts.
A lot of different accounts. And so, you know, it's a Jerry Maguire type effect, right? You have one, you're looking out for number one here. You got one person looking out for number one or you know, one entity looking out for number one in this case. And I think that played a big role as well.
So what do you think this means? Because, you know, over the years, you and I have been in this game long enough to hear all of the various conspiracy theories between, oh, MLS is SUM, which, you know, it is, and SUM and U.S. soccer are too closely connected and there's a conflict of interest there. But there's also the other element of the deal that I sort of hit at the intro, which is like, hey, this was, you know, in most years, a profit center for MLS too that is no longer. So what do you think this means for MLS now that we fit on the U.S. soccer side of it?
Well, it's hard to say because SUM is a private company, right? But I think from my conversations with different sources, they certainly were playing down just how big of a profit center U.S. soccer was as a as a portion or a fraction of what Soccer United Marketing does. Not that it didn't generate profit. Certainly, they wouldn't be taking this on if it didn't generate profit, but that the money itself wasn't the real motivator behind taking on U.S. soccer. So let's go back to when this all started. SUM was created in order to better sell soccer in this country. And they started SUM by taking on U.S. soccer. At the time, IMG was selling the commercial rights of U.S. soccer. They were losing money and they were looking to get out of the contract early. And MLS created Soccer United Marketing and they purchased that contract from IMG. So I think we should first recognize that IMG, wasn't making money on U.S. soccer at the time. And the MLS goal at that point was, if we can sell and increase the value of U.S. soccer as an entity, it's going to be a really good thing for MLS too, right? Because we're increasing the value of soccer in the United States in general. And sure. That is what people I spoke to kind of claimed was really the motivating factor this entire time. U.S. soccer through this contract was receiving from SUM $30 million a year, guaranteed. $30 million a year, no matter how they performed. So in some year, and then anything above $30 million, there was a revenue share agreement, and that was a tiered revenue share agreement. So, in a year like 2018, when you missed the World Cup, MLS and SUM took a huge hit, right? They lost money. They never hit that $30 million guarantee that they still had to pay out, right?
Right. In a year when they would have been anticipating going way above it.
Yeah. But then you go back and you look at 2014 or even the Copa America Centenario and the amount of money that was made, there's significant money to be made there. I'm pretty sure some worked on the Copa America Centenario deal as well. I'd be surprised if they didn't.
Yeah, I think so.
So, there was give and take from the people I spoke to. The impression I got was this isn't a massive financial hit for Soccer United Marketing. This is a multi-billion dollar business. It's been valued as such. We know that because MLS bought back a portion of SUM from an investment firm at that valuation. They still represent Major League Soccer, right? Obviously. They still represent the FMF. They still represent CONCACAF. And so, is it important? Is it significant? Sure, it hurts the value anytime you lose a property like this. But I don't think that, looking at some of the questions we got for the Twitter Q&A portion of the show, there were a few questions about whether it would impact franchise valuations, whether it would destroy the league. It's not that significant of a financial hit. It is a financial hit, but it's not that significant of one that it would destroy valuations of a club. SUM still exists and SUM will still make money.
Yeah, especially with the Mexico partnership, which is basically only growing and only becoming more important.
And Major League Soccer too. I mean, the commercial arm of Major League Soccer, this is a demographic. The people who watch soccer in this country is a very desirable demographic. And when you look at, like, for example, I think it was a season ago or two seasons ago, MLS had sold out all of its inventory on ad sales for national TV. Now, you want those ad rates to go up, right? With ratings. Yeah. But the fact that it's selling out its ad inventory is a sign of just how badly advertisers want to reach the audience that tunes in MLS.
Do you know if that's typical for other leagues? I would assume it is.
I would expect it is, but I believe in the conversation I had, I have to go back to my notes on this, but I believe that this sellout had happened prior to the start of the season for the entire year's inventory, which I think is a little bit what they were trying to say is, the ratings aren't the only indication of the success of Major League Soccer, right? And that's what I'm trying to say here. The ratings, the TV ratings aren't the only indication of the commercial success of Major League Soccer and SUM. And that's why there's still significant valuation behind SUM, that they have MLS, they have FMF in the United States, they have CONCACAF.
Leagues Cup.
All of those things factor into the properties of SUM and all of those things are more profitable than, you know, the revenue driven day to day by Major League Soccer teams.
So you brought up ratings. Let's just get right into it. What do you think this does for the TV deal? I mean, you kind of mentioned like, hey, like this isn't going to sink. It's not going to be a death knell or anything like that. You know, we were talking about this the other day, you and I, and you made a good point that like, as part of this deal, the main matches that MLS can sell for the men's national team are World Cup qualifiers. You know what's not going to exist? Home World Cup qualifiers specifically. Those aren't going to exist before 2026. Or I don't think that's official yet. I don't think FIFA has said that all three countries are going to automatically qualify, but that's the expectation. And so those games might not even exist. You don't have that inventory there. The interesting side to me, Paul, and this is not something that we spend a lot of time talking about on this show, is the women's side. Because that's the most popular team in terms of the men's versus women's national teams. You know, that's the more successful one, certainly. And they have more friendly matches on the schedule, like She Believes Cup, and more things that fall under that sum, or would have fallen under that sum purview, than the men. And to me, that's the biggest kind of revenue stream when you're talking about media rights and the national teams specifically that the league is now losing out on. But what do you think this does for the TV deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, obviously it's going to make the package weaker, and especially because Major League Soccer was trying to put together as big a package as possible with, you know, all of the local deals in market, out of market, the streaming deal, the international deal, all of the national deal, all of it was put together in one package, right? Where that's how they're shaping it now for this bidding process. And
Still is.
Yeah, it still is. And so you wanted to put, yeah, would they have packaged U.S. Soccer with it to make it even stronger? Of course. To your point, on the men's national team side, not only are you likely losing home qualifiers from the TV package this time around, but the number of friendlies that U.S. soccer plays have dropped off significantly because of Nations League. And Nations League is owned by CONCACAF and not by U.S. soccer. So those games are out the window as well. And you're right. The women's national team, there are more properties owned by U.S. soccer. There are friendlies that do better TV ratings and always have than U.S. soccer. The U.S. men's national team friendlies, you know, how many people are tuning in for USA Costa Rica on February 1st coming out of January national team camp? You know, not that many people. So, you know, that all of those things have to be considered. But do I think it weakens the television deal for Major League Soccer? Yeah, of course. You're losing an important entity. Do I think it, completely alters what the TV deal will look like? No, I don't. Because I think the strength of this upcoming deal is especially going to be the streaming content that MLS will provide. When you look at what's happening right now with CBS and Paramount Plus, when you look at NBC and Peacock, when you look at ESPN and ESPN Plus, there's a lot of competition right now because soccer fans, the demographic of soccer fans are younger. They're more likely to consume via streaming and they're more likely to purchase, subscription services to watch soccer. And so they are an entry point to buy your subscription program. And I think that's why we'll see the TV deal look much better for Major League Soccer this time around. I don't know how much better, but, you know, as Don Garber told me, he feels like they are entering the market at exactly the right time. And I don't think that this is going to be like some event that has drastically changed or shaped the scope of the TV deal by losing the national team. I don't think that's the balance anymore between MLS and the national team as it might have been back in 2006 ahead of the World Cup, or even, you know, 2010 when the league was in a completely different place.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to just provide a little bit of context here. So those streaming networks that you mentioned, just some numbers. CBS recently paid reportedly $75 million per year for 3 years of Serie A rights. ESPN reportedly paying $175 million per year over the next 8 years for the La Liga rights in the U.S. MLS, in contrast, gets $90 million a year in its current deal, which includes those national team games, right, from Fox, ESPN, and Univision.
Which they pay out $30 million to U.S. soccer guaranteed, so we know what's left over just off the bat there, right?
Now, there are other things that come with that $30 million in terms of sponsorship. It's not just purely media, but yeah, just for a little bit of context there. And then you sort of got at this, but one of Garber's quotes to you, you know, he feels like it's the perfect time for the market. And part of the reason he feels like that is the fact that the fan base, the MLS fan base, the quote, young, almost cable never soccer fan is very, very inclined to view soccer programming through streaming services, end quote. And I think that's a real feather in MLS's cap heading into this next deal. I still don't really know what to think about it. I have people that are super bullish on it. I have people that are pessimistic on it that I've spoken to. We'll see where it ends up. Is it going to be 3x the current deal? I don't know. That sounds kind of high to me. Is it going to be two? I would expect probably at least two.
Well, we've talked about this, Sam. The dynamics have changed drastically since the last TV deal, right? It went from 20 teams in MLS to what will be 29 and probably 30 teams.
There are a lot more people wanting slices of pie now than there were before.
So for the deal to be a significant game changer for MLS teams, it's going to have to be a massive, massive jump. And I think we also have to factor that into this TV deal. You know, when you're signing the last TV deal, it does matter that there are fewer teams in fewer markets around the country, right? Now you have a league that's active in more markets in the United States, that's active in more active in bigger markets in the United States. And I think it's worth pointing out, Sam, you've been tracking this for us so far this year. The TV numbers suddenly have looked better this year, which is kind of surprising to me. They've been
more
prominent, like, I think partly because they've been on the big channels early in the season, Fox, big ABC. That's probably helped. But we are seeing an uptick that I think is, you know, we've been hovering around like mid 300s for the last few years, mid 200s to mid 300s. And we've seen a couple numbers that are, you know, in the fives, in the sixes, in the sevens.
It's been better, I think, for sure. I'm curious to see how sustainable it is over the course of the year. But they've been up, I think, even year over year compared to previous seasons. So I think that's positive for MLS. Like, I wrote about this a lot in that story I did on valuations, right? It's not so much about where you are right now, but where you're trending, right? And if the league can say, hey, we're on the rise, right? Buy low, and you'll get in at good value, you know, and take this massive ride with us, rocket ship to the moon, if you got those diamond strong hands, man. You know? MLS is Dogecoin, Paul. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, you are a major Doge investor, and you are essentially investing your life in Major League Soccer. So you are really going to have diamond strong hands, Sam, or else it's going to be a sad, sad ending to this story.
You can just call me the Big Doge from now on. I think that's a good place to take a break on this topic. And we're going to come back. We're going to do the Q&A like Paul mentioned. But I want to hit on something, at least quickly, that Paul and I have had discussions about casual and avid fans, and how does MLS convince people to make that jump. We'll be right back after the break.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And we are back. This is Paul Tenorio bringing us back from a break. Sam needed a, you know, he needed a rest. He needed to think about Doge and MLS.
Paul's carrying the piano now.
Finally, you know.
I'm here to tickle the ivories, baby.
So, Sam, we had a conversation. I was speaking with someone in Major League Soccer just about the kind of interesting breakdown of fans and the challenge that MLS faces in needing to appeal to both a casual sports fan and casual soccer fan and try to get them to start tuning into Major League Soccer to grow its fan base. And then also having a really important task of catering to the diehard fans that are the most loyal fans of MLS, the ones that we see in all of the advertising campaigns, the ones that we believe kind of drive the atmosphere and the product for Major League Soccer. And, you know, for us, for me personally, it's been an interesting journey as a Major League Soccer reporter because I feel like I have lived that experience, right? When I was working at the Orlando Sentinel, I had a job that was not just reporting on Orlando City day to day, but because I was working for the local newspaper, my task was to write for an audience that was both the diehard fans in Orlando and also the Orlando Sentinel subscribers who do not care about soccer, the people that would send me mean emails and write the older people, especially, who would send me handwritten letters to the Orlando Sentinel newsroom telling me to stop writing about soccer. And so
start writing again about Blake Bortles.
Exactly. More Bortles, less MLS. And Bortles. So I had to write for both, right? I had to write stories in a way that would educate people about MLS and about soccer and make them interested in maybe showing up to a game or make them interested in reading my next story about Orlando City. But then I also was writing a lot of stories that I still write now that are very allocation disordery, that were very much, you know, pointed toward the diehard Orlando City fans who wanted to talk about building the roster and who fit and who didn't and why they signed Breck Shea and how much money he was, you know, how much money they were spending and all those types of things. When I left the Sentinel and went to 442 and now the Athletic, my audience narrowed, right? And this is the audience we kind of write for, Sam, and that you wrote for when you were writing for MLSsoccer.com. Those are the diehards that are reading us. And if you're listening to this podcast, there are very high odds that you are a diehard MLS fan.
Yeah. You're probably a psycho.
Yeah, you're definitely.
I say that with love.
A little bit crazy for sure. At least,
and we are the craziest of these people.
Yeah,
just
because
full disclosure,
we do this podcast, which is just even more of an indictment. But you know what I've started to think more about as we discuss story ideas and when we talk about kind of what we're doing with this show is that part of we are definitely appealing to the diehards. But we also want to convert, you know, good MLS fans into diehard fans, right? We want people to get interested in the things we're interested about because that's what we write about, the things that interest us for the most part. There are some stories that get assigned to us that we're less excited about. But, you know, you want people to kind of, you know, get interested in the things you're writing about. And so
we want to be the gateway drug.
Yeah, exactly. We're exactly that, right? We're the first little, you know, bump or whatever. And then we're off to the races, you know? And I think that's an important part of kind of any sports journalism is that, you know, we're all catering to some different level of fan. But I think when you look at NFL coverage and NBA coverage, Major League Baseball coverage, you know, when you get to a certain level of the coverage, it starts to turn and say, okay, like, we are your introduction to really getting into the nitty gritty, to really diving into the details. And we're going to turn you from being somebody who flips on an NFL game every once in a while on a Sunday to sitting on your couch watching Red Zone or going to a sports bar all day long and watching every NFL game or, you know, doing what I also do, which is take part in a way too complicated fantasy football league that has a luxury tax in its draft. And I think that, you know, I think that's an important role too, Sam. I've talked a lot about this, Sam. I'm going to take a second to say, how do you see it? What do you think about the kind of the back and forth of selling MLS, of what MLS has to do, less us, but what MLS has to do in selling to two very different types of fans?
Well, yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic because I think you can frame it as this like conflict, right? on the one side, you have the diehard fans who are here and they're not really going anywhere unless you do something totally crazy, like change your name to Columbus SC. And even then, most of those people are going to stick around, right? So in some ways, MLS doesn't really need to try and go get those people. They're already in the door. You don't want to spend your time and your energy and your money on capturing customers that you already have, right? That makes sense. You want to go and expand and grow and capture new people that maybe are halfway in the door or not yet in the door, right? And MLS needs to do that and should be trying to do that. But I think it's wrong to frame it as a conflict, right? And I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive in terms of giving hardcore fans what they want and trying to grow the league in that direction, whether that's in terms of, you know, involving them in a rebrand or trying to facilitate a stadium that can be a really awesome atmosphere, right? Driven by the people who are here and who have been here and have been committed for years, right? And so you can do those things while also trying to go out and get new people in the door. And I think if you do the first part, right, if you take care of the hardcore, I think that drives a lot of that atmosphere. And that is the most compelling thing you can do as a league, right? Apart from raising the level of play dramatically, and that's a more local thing anyway, right? Team to team. That's the most compelling thing you can do as a broader league to get more people interested and get more people involved, right? And so I think those two things go hand in hand. And I think kind of this idea that it's zero sum or it's one against the other. And if we're doing one, then that means we're doing less of the other. I think that's kind of a fallacy. And I don't know. I think that's kind of interesting. When I think about like my journey as a MLS person, whatever you want to call it, right? Like I've sort of discovered, I always think back to an article I wrote at MLS and it was just like on a whim. It was like completely on a whim. It was like late afternoon, some weird trade, it was a GAM for TAM trade between DC United and Toronto FC. And it was one of the first of those that had ever happened. And I was like, this is funny. I know kind of what this means. Let me get on the phone, get some quotes, get some people to give me some stuff on background so I can explain it. And I wrote over the course of probably 2 hours or something from start to finish, wrote and published a piece kind of explaining this trade. And people loved it, like loved it. And not just people that were like hardcore, but people that were maybe a little more halfway in, right? And the response I got to that article, both on like Twitter and on my phone, and like people in MLS, clubs, fans were reaching out to me to be like, hey, I loved this. This really made sense. And that sort of like showed me, hey, there's an appetite for this stuff, right? And that's what you and I try and do all the time, is feed that appetite. Right. And I'm not saying like the league is in the business, needs to be in the business of doing that necessarily. I think in some ways they are, in some ways they aren't. But I don't know. I don't know if this answers the question. I just do think that it shouldn't be a battle. Those two ideas shouldn't be competing with each other. They should be working in concert.
Yeah. I think there's a couple things that I want to kind of piggyback on there. And that idea of these things going together or feeding the diehard fans kind of playing into, you know, the way that you can sell this league to a wider audience, right? And, you know, for me, I look at it like Columbus Crew as a great example. Like Columbus needs to expand its season ticket holding base. It needs to grow. But you don't have to go and become Columbus SC to do that, to appeal to a wider audience. What you need to do is get people to show up at your game and have them see the atmosphere and realize that it's different than what they can get going to an NHL game or an Ohio State game. Not that it's better, that it's different. It's a different type of environment for, for sports fans. And the example I have of that really just stands out in my mind is I thought Orlando City and Phil Rollins, Brett Lashbrook was involved at the time, did a brilliant job when Orlando City came into the league in that the entire campaign was built around filling the Citrus Bowl. They didn't expect that 62,000 people would come back for the second game. What they wanted was for, 50,000 people or maybe even more, depending on how you look at it, being introduced to the ILF and the Ruckus, the two supporters groups, and what a soccer atmosphere could look like, and to feel the energy of 60,000 people in the stands for a soccer game, and everyone rising up and screaming when Kaká's free kick went in to tie it at the end of the game, and that you could get that excitement, that you could get that thrill, that you could hear the drums, and you could hear everything that was soccer, right? That was different than a Florida State football game or a UCF football game or a Magic game or whatever. And it worked. People came back that wouldn't have come back. When the Galaxy came into town and the second time they opened the upper bowl with no real preparation a week ahead of time, they put 40,000 plus people in the stands. You know, that was due to the, you know, that was due more to the experience of the opening game than it was to what product was on the field. Getting 40,000 people to show up wasn't about to see the Galaxy. It wasn't about stars on the field. It was about people wanting to feel that experience again. And so, you know, I think that that shows that if you push towards the diehard fans, the atmosphere, it sells casual fans. The second thing I want to say, and this doesn't help me or you at all, so I always hesitate to say it in a very public sphere, but I have said it to other people privately. It's not like I'm trying to like always and only help myself. But like, I always feel as an example of this, that like breaking news, which is something that you and I do as part of our job, like if I were a team PR person, I would never... I mean, not that any PR people are like leaking us stuff anyways, but like if you're running comms or you're part of a club, like in my opinion, you should be breaking, quote unquote, every single story, every single signing should be handed to the local newspaper, because you're reaching another audience. You're still satisfying your diehard fans, giving them the information that they're going to want. But if you just put it out on your Twitter page, you're reaching the people who already follow you, and that's it. You know, even if you go to us, you're reaching a wider MLS audience, but the chances are you're reaching MLS fans. And what we do is explain why a signing is happening. And we really want the nitty gritty of like what went into this deal. And maybe that's a different type of audience. But for the news itself, you want that on the front page of the sports page of the Orlando Sentinel or of the Washington Post or of the Kansas City Star. And those, by the way, you see it in a lot of those markets, Kansas City and DC mm-hmm. and Orlando. And that's because you're trying to expand your reach. And again, that's another example of I'm satisfying my soccer audience who also subscribe to this local paper, but I'm now also reaching more fans and different fans and giving them an opportunity to read that story or see it on the front page and understand yeah. that we're a major league team.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a key thing. And not every market even has that available to it, right? NYCFC and the New York Red Bulls can go to the New York Times all they want about, you know, whatever signing they're making, you know, and it's not going to, you know, it's not going to be in the paper most likely. Yeah, it's unless it's David Villa or Frank
Tirani. You shouldn't go to the Times for that anyway, but yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I don't know how often you want to be on the back page of the Post, you know, necessarily.
Imagine some of those headlines, man. Like the Rafa Marquez game when he got ejected for, like, throwing a ball at Landon Donovan's head. Oh, my goodness. The Roy Miller free kick on the back of the New York Post. It would have been incredible.
Yeah, we should write some revisionist
headlines.
We need some allocation disorder fans to tweet us some good headlines of MLS moments in the back of the New York Post, Red Bull and NYCFC moments.
Or just any moments at all. You can expand it. Get creative. We know you're creative out there. Let's see how creative you are. But anyway, I do think it's interesting, and I just hope the league is fundamentally thinking of it in those ways and not seeing it as a conflict. Like that, I think that's my main takeaway here. I'm not totally sure of that one way or another. I think certainly some people with the league would view it that way, but, you know, it's a tough balance to strike. It's a difficult walk to walk, or a line to walk, rather. But I do think it's one that's pretty important, and will be important for the league as it continues, because what it wants, right, is what we see at The Athletic in the UK, or what we see with The Athletic NFL. Right, where it's like multiple writers per team and every single little move or action or decision is dissected 10 different ways, right? And people eat it up. And I think there's an element of that in MLS. Obviously, it's more niche and it's smaller. But, you know, I think if the league can continue building that, then, you know, maybe it can continue growing and get there a little bit faster where it wants to go. Anything else to add on the subject before we get to these Q&As?
Q&A. Anyone who ever helps us break news as a source heard that last part. Ignore it. Thank you.
There you go. And with that, we'll take a break. We'll be back with a Q&A section to close out the show.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help you find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn, though, isn't just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Speaking from experience, hiring for a small business, it's difficult when you're wearing so many hats. You might not have the time or the resources to hire. LinkedIn makes it very easy to complete the job hiring process. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. Comes very well recommended from this guy. And also 2.5 million small businesses who are using LinkedIn for hiring. On LinkedIn, did you know 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours? That's a quick turnaround to hire professionals on LinkedIn. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you.
And we are back. Final segment of today's show. We're doing it a little bit differently on this show. We're doing a little Q&A. We're recording a day earlier than we usually do. We're recording on a Wednesday. Our schedules are kind of out of whack this week. It's still coming out on Friday, so you're listening to this on Friday. Hopefully no news happens between now and when we record. Otherwise, you might not be listening to this, and there might be a new show entirely. But let's hope that doesn't happen. Let's dive right into the Q&A, though. We asked for questions. A bunch of you asked them. So first is from Jeff Prescott. Any word on the penalty for Miami having four DPs on the roster in 2020? The announcement that MLS had determined Miami violated the rules came out 40 days ago. It's many days.
Well, Don Garber actually addressed this to reporters in Cincinnati when the stadium opened. And what he said was basically interviews are still being done and an announcement on a penalty still isn't yet at that. We're not at that phase yet. He didn't put a timeline on it this time, which is much smarter because he put a timeline on it last time and that timeline
maybe got a little ahead of himself, huh?
Yeah, he got a little ahead of himself. I do think that this is in the works. I've heard so many different kind of rumors and thoughts about what it might be. Obviously, not enough to report it. You know, we want everything to be vetted and not speculative before we ever put reporting down. But, you know, there will be a punishment. They are going through the process still. There are interviews happening. This isn't just like from what I've been told too. It's not just like it's like a like lazy kind of internal process where you're just like talking to somebody on the phone about something. Like this kind of thing has to, if you're going to punish somebody or punish a team, like there's things you have to like, you have to cross your T's and dot your I's in many different ways. So I think all of that stuff is being done as well. I would expect a punishment to be announced before the summer window opens. So before, you know, what would
July
that be
7th.
Like July? Yeah, July 7th. But you know, I don't know, man. TBD. We keep hearing different things, Sam. Have you heard anything different?
No, not really. I mean, the one thing that I would just kind of add to what you said is that like everyone that I've spoken to about this expects a pretty significant punishment. I think summer window would make sense in terms of doing it before the summer window would make sense because I don't think that punishment is going to affect anything for Miami this season. I think it would probably be for 2022 and potentially beyond. So doing it before the summer window would allow them to kind of plan out a little bit further in terms of what signings they will or will not make this summer. So I think that could be important, but you know, the league doesn't necessarily have to give Miami any benefit like that. You know, it's not like they've earned it because they broke the rules. So we'll see. But yeah, that's basically same thing I would have said. So.
All right. Let's go to the next question. This one's from Red and Orange Kenny. Houston and RSL
Kenny.
are currently in a playoff position and a point away from one, respectively. Given the sale processes of both teams and how it could impact the summer transfer window, would it be a shock for one or both teams to make the playoffs?
Yes and no. I mean, it's MLS. Like, anyone can make the playoffs. Seven teams make it in each conference. You know, a lot of teams make it. Would it be the most shocking thing to see either of them make it? No, not at all. I would be more surprised if Houston made it, because I don't think they're as good as Salt Lake in terms of their roster. Salt Lake also still has Bobby Wood on the way, although the way Rubio Rubin is going, maybe they don't need him quite as much as they thought. In terms of the ownership situation, I mean, I don't think RSL, I think RSL, they've been connected to a TAM signing out of Argentina. I'm blanking on the guy's name. It's Jonathan something. So they've been connected to that. I think they probably have the budget and the space to make a TAM ad. Houston, I think, if anything, the ownership news helps them, because I think they showed this offseason that ownership wasn't going to spend money on players. Right, they got rid of Ellis, they sold him, they sold Minotas. They didn't really do anything to go out and replace either of those guys, at least with new incoming signings in a significant way. So maybe if that deal can get closed, maybe the floodgate opens a little bit and Houston can go out and make a move. So if anything, I think it should help. I don't think that the ownership situation is going to have a significant impact beyond what we already knew. And if one made the playoffs, I wouldn't be that surprised. If both made the playoffs, I would be surprised, but I mean, it's MLS. I'm wrong about this stuff like 90% of the time. What about you? Sound about right?
Yeah, I think so. I'd be surprised if either ownership sale happened fast enough to have an impact on the summer transfer window. Even if the sale for Houston goes through, I don't know how quickly you're going to the new owner being like, hey, we have to sign this guy for, you know, a $7 million DP in Houston or something like that. Like, maybe a TAM deal goes through, maybe a free agent deal goes through, like, in the global market. But I'd be surprised. I don't know. I mean, maybe the Houston owners would want to come in and say, and have already said to Matt Jordan, you know, look, we want to come in and make a splash right away and announce ourselves. But for the most part, I think there's a lot of due diligence that goes into what am I taking over? What does everyone's contract look like? What does the roster look like for next year? And try to figure out where things stand before they start committing to 3 and 4 year DP and young money contracts. So I'd be surprised in general if the summer window was impacted too much by ownership sales.
For sure. This one comes from Tim Katz. And Paul, this one, I mean, it's definitely got to be asked to you. These are your boys. How confident should we be that things will improve in Harrison with the Red Bulls? Does Struber make it to the end of the season if they don't? Yes to the answer, to answer that second part of the question. Sorry, I stole that from you.
It's okay. First of all, I agree with you. Absolutely, Struber will be coaching by the end of the season. They paid, $2 million for him in a transfer fee?
$2.75 million,
even more reason why he'll be here at the end of the year.
I think the third biggest transfer fee in club history.
Right. I personally believe that things are going to turn around significantly for the Red Bulls, to the tune of, you know, going to second in the league by the end of the year. That's how significantly
you're not backing off that, even with Aaron Long.
I'm not backing off. There are options if you're the Red Bulls to replace Aaron Long. Ventura Alvarado's trying to come to MLS. He's an option. You could go make a
Andres
trade.
Andres Reyes had a very eventful game over the weekend.
I like Andres Reyes as a prospect. You're going to have to go through some ups and downs with him, but I liked him in Miami. I still think he can be a good player. You know, you could go try to make a trade for somebody. You know, you think about the kind of athleticism that Red Bull center backs have and kind of what they ask of them to press high. Like, maybe you go to Chicago and you ask for Calvo. You take Calvo off Chicago's hands. And
that's going to get them to second in the league. Didn't you bury Calvo on this show last week?
I'm just trying to help the fire out after I buried them last week. That's all I was trying to do there.
Got it.
Yes, I think things will get better. I really do believe that this is a team that just need some time together. They're super young. They added a lot of pieces. I like Klemala as a player. I think he's going to get better as he gets more minutes and gets more fit. Same with Frankie Amaya. I think things will be better in New York.
I agree too.
Okay, Sam. Let's go here to Adam Porter. Which teams are in most need of the upcoming international break, and who do you think it could hurt? Also, should the Croupier announce Perry Kitchen as Kevin at all of their matches now?
Yeah, Kevin SC, I believe, is what I would go with on that one. Kevin Kitchen does have a nice ring to it. You know, some alliteration there. I don't hate it, man.
Zlatan is he's a genius, man.
Yeah, he's God or something. I don't know. Depends who you ask. Which teams are most in need of the upcoming international break? Portland? I think those guys, they can't stop getting hurt. It's been brutal for them. Andy Polo is now out for the year. They just announced that the other day after the shocking tackle that Derek Williams had on him from the Galaxy game over the weekend. And he's just one of a long list of players. So they need some time to rest and recover and recoup. And, you know, like right now, they're just walking wounded. Like, they don't have a bunch of players that they can field on a game-by-game basis to try and get results. So they need some time to recover. So I think Portland is clear number one there. In terms of teams that could hurt, I didn't really thought of it this way. I mean, anytime you're rolling, you want to keep rolling, right? Who's been rolling the most? Seattle. So, you know, that being said, some time off maybe for Nico Ladero to get back to full fitness. We saw him make a cameo appearance, and he didn't. He hasn't played since. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him. But yeah, maybe Seattle. What about you? You have any other different shouts on that one?
Yeah, I think DC United could probably use the break. They need to just maybe catch their breath a little bit with the changeover that's happened and the fitness.
I don't think Losada will let them catch their breath.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think just getting a little bit of a breather would be helpful to them. I think the teams that have been struggling in the league, I think, could use the break. So Chicago Fire, Cincinnati, I think it's good to kind of step back, especially if you're Chicago. I know this will seem counterintuitive to what you just said, but if you started the way you did and then you get two wins in a row at home, I actually think it would be a good time to take a break and just say, okay, we're going into this break with some positive momentum after a negative start. We're feeling good about ourselves. We've got things going. Let's fine tune some things and come back out firing.
Kind of hammer home your new principles.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another team that I think will benefit or could benefit depending on what happens this weekend from the break.
Okay. I have a question for you, Paul. Actually, I have two questions for you. First, from Antoine Latron. Don't you think Paul Tenorio looks like Alex Roldan? Yeah, he kind of does. Paul, what do you think?
No, I don't. I think Alex Roldan, if anything, looks a little bit like me because I'm significantly older than Alex Roldan, first of all. And, you know, second of all, I don't have a second of all. My first of all is that I'm the oldest. I get the veteran priority.
Age before beauty is what you're saying.
Well, in this case, age and beauty.
Well, you look alike, so, you know, you can't really hate on it too much, right? And then second question, another kind of fun one. This is from our buddy Felipe Cardenas. Who's the Kevin of the Athletic soccer staff?
Man, that's a tough one to put me on the spot about. I feel like the Kevin of our staff is probably, well, first of all, there has to be a Zlatan of the staff, and that's definitely you. You're definitely Zlatan. So the question is, who are you most likely to call Kevin on the staff? And I think it's probably Jeff Reuter, because he's the youngest.
I don't think so.
And I think you might give him the hardest time. I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
Assassinated my character completely. Okay.
Who is the most likely to go in front of his colleagues and say, I am God? I guess it could be Pablo.
I wouldn't do that. I mean, I might be most likely, but I would not do that. Okay? Like, just to be clear.
It's between you and Pablo. As
like most like the jump between most likely and actually doing it, there are many, many off ramps on that highway.
I'm not arguing that you are Zlatan. I think we all know that you're not Zlatan. But You're the most likely to do a Zlatan-esque.
I don't know. I like to think it's more positive reinforcement for me, although the delivery might be a little out there sometimes. Many people don't know this about me. I can get like pretty intense about things. Sort of famous on the team for that sort of stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I think last year, I think I gave like a motivational speech via WhatsApp one time. Got a little unhinged.
Then left the WhatsApp group. So it just goes to show the emotional roller coaster.
That is kind of prima donna like behavior. Can't really argue. When you put it like that. Okay. Who's
your Kevin? Who is your Kevin?
I think I don't know. I don't know, man. Maybe, like, if I'm Zlatan, the one I'm most likely to have a go at is you, if we're being honest.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's Felipe, because maybe we'll just call him Philip from now on, just like many people have done his entire life. You are now Phil.
Felipe Carr. Phil Carr. That's his new name.
Phil Carr.
Okay. All right. I think it's your turn to ask me a question.
All right, Sam. This one's from Sean Hardgrove. How excited are you for Clint Dempsey, studio analyst?
I'm excited because I have no idea what's coming, like, at all. Like, most times when you see a player, it's like they go into an analyst role, you kind of have a vague idea of how they're going to be, you know? Like, I have no idea what Clint Dempsey's going to do. He could be terrible. He could be amazing. It probably will be something in between. But, you know, if he goes out there and the studio host tosses to him and it's like, Clint, what were your thoughts on the match? And he just goes, you know, I thought it was a good game, pimp. And, like, that's it. That would be amazing. Like, give him an Emmy right now if he does that. Like, that would be fantastic. I'm interested to see what he does. And, like, it's a studio show. They're inherently uninteresting. So I think it's a major win just to have him on. Even if the interest is momentary, it is there. What about you? You excited?
Oh, I'm super excited, pimp? I'm super pumped. I think my big fear is that he'll be boring, which would be so disappointing because the players that we've seen come on, the former U.S. soccer players, not all of them, but some of them have been kind of boring and bland. And it's like, okay, like, you know, we want personality. And you can see, like, the difference if you bring some personality, we see more of you, right? Stu Holden, Moadu, you know, we start to see more. So I think that Dempsey's going to be great. I hope he keeps it real. Our colleague, Chris Camerani, is doing a story. It'll definitely already be published by the time you guys are listening to this on Friday. But I think one of the benefits right off the jump of this edition is that they got an interview with Christian Pulisic. It was, Clint Dempsey, Gucho Nyewu, and, I think one other person on this broadcast. And that Christian Pulisic apparently was more open and kind of vulnerable or willing to share than he has been in pretty much any other interview. And I think part of that is, one, you can't turn down an interview with Clint Dempsey. You can't do that. So you're going to get anyone.
You can.
At your own risk, my friend.
He just won't call you a pimp anymore.
And second of all, like, yeah, I think it helps to have somebody who's done what he's done be a part of the group. So I think it'll be a good thing overall. I'm excited for it. I'm just excited for the reemergence of Clint Dempsey in general. You know, he went on to the podcast.
I don't know that I am.
I'm excited selfishly because I would like to book a flight to North Carolina and go, you know, hunting and fishing and golfing with Clint Dempsey.
You know what, Paul? I'm in North Carolina right now. Like, right now. I'm in Western North Carolina. You know where Clint Dempsey lives? Western North Carolina. Maybe I should go find him.
Maybe you should. I think he's probably going to be
Hanging out with my brother. We're going to go find him right after the show. It's going to be a Viking quest for Clint Dempsey. It's going to be exciting. A couple of these questions I believe we have already addressed in earlier portions of the show. This one comes from MFT. Not NFT, but MFT. MLS has fewer domestic player minutes in it than all of the big five European leagues except for the English Premier League. Could you discuss how the economic model disincentivizes domestic development in MLS? It's a bit of a leading question because I think there are some ways that it incentivizes it as well. But Paul, take that one away.
Yeah, well, I think it certainly incentivizes it now. It didn't always, right? The whole point of what the league is doing right now is to try to incentivize MLS teams to put more money into youth development and to put more of those young players onto the field and then to sell them. So it's not surprising to me that the domestic minutes are down in MLS. It's very simply a part of where MLS is now and where the sport is now in this country, which is and has always been significantly behind all of the big five leagues. And that matters. Why? Because as they've tried to grow a little bit more rapidly on a little bit more of a rapid timeline than those other leagues just out of necessity. In order to increase the quality of the product on the field, they had to put more money into it. And where was that money going to go to quickly enhance the product? It was going to go abroad. And we saw that with targeted allocation money. And we're going to see that with young money as well. Though I think I'm not 100% sure that it definitely won't be at the same rate, I don't think, as TAM. I think we'll see more domestic players given young money status than we are expecting, or that I was expecting when this rule first got introduced. But I do think that, that's the reason why the domestic minutes are lower. One, the player pool couldn't sustain the rate of expansion growth. Two, MLS needed to quickly flood the league with quality players in order to enhance the quality on the field, and that brought players from abroad. And three, the academy system in this country is only 14 years old. 14 years old, that's it. I mean, in the lifespan of youth development and creating, you know, first team players, we are so early in the process. And we're really just starting to see those players that spent an entire developmental phase from 9 through 14, 15, 16, getting pumped out of those academies and being put onto teams, not just in Major League Soccer, but in Europe as well. So I think those numbers are going to continue to climb. I think, you know, certainly this league is going to be, I think, more dependent on foreign talent in the meantime than the Portuguese league, or, you know, than going up to Spain or to France, where especially France, like, how you don't really need to go outside of the country because you have so much talent at your disposal. That's not the case here. So it's not super surprising. And I don't think it's about the economic model as much as it's about where the talent pool is and the amount of time it's going to take to increase the domestic talent pool.
Yeah, I would say the way that no, not really at all. I would say one thing that I would add on the other side of the argument is the way that MLS is structured with DPs and TAM and all of those things. I would say maybe that the buckets, maybe that pushes a little bit more international than if it was like a flat cap, but maybe not. I could be off about that, right? So I'd be curious to kind of explore that more in my own head, maybe on this podcast, maybe in an article. I don't know. Those are things that probably won't happen, but it's something that's worth thinking about a little bit more. So I pretty much agree with what you just said there. Whose turn is it, Paul? Who's up to ask?
It's my turn to ask you a question. So Brandon Klein asked a question that we answered at the beginning of the show when we were talking about some. Mike Miller had a question that was similar about RSL ownership, but he asked a question, I think it's an important one. Does the completion of the Orlando and Houston deals make it more likely that an RSL deal is going to go through soon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's not like any like huge, like crazy theory. It's just there's only one team left on the market now. So that increases demand, right? And I guess there's two technically if you include Sacramento and whatever might happen with that expansion spot. But yeah, I think it does kind of grease the wheels a little bit. You know, there's more of a market price that has been set now for these teams. And I think with a distressed asset, which I think is what you can maybe call RSL at this point in time, MLS probably wanted to have that market set itself in Orlando and Houston before selling at Salt Lake, so it doesn't have to sell for pennies on the dollar, right? And it can kind of goose that valuation a little bit higher, whereas if it was like, okay, DeLahanson is out because of his racist behavior and maybe this team's available at discount, I think there's less of a chance of the league having to go through that discussion now. I don't think they ever would have sold it like that, but I think they can like just skip that part at this point and really only get interested buyers who are going to play full market value for that team. So yeah, I think it helps. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I for all the reasons you just said, I do think it's important that they've been able to see now two transactions happen quite quickly back to back, very different types of transactions in terms of what kind of real estate was involved. But, you know, the Houston transaction certainly helps the valuation of the soccer club itself. The Orlando transaction gives some idea of a transaction with a stadium involved and multiple entities. So I do think that it'll help that RSL sale move along. And we know that they have a favorite in that. I'm forgetting the name of who it is that's in the lead now.
Guy with the Devils and the Sixers ownership group. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that process is now starting to move along.
All right. I think we have one last question here. And there was another one that I think we'll touch on later in the week in the story. So we're going to hold off on asking it right now. But one last one, NYCFC specific. The club bought This is from My Name Leroy, which is definitely the best username we got out of all of these questions. Thanks, Leroy. NYCFC bought Thiago Talismagno and possibly Santiago Rodriguez this window and still have one designated player spot open. First, should this redeem David Lee in the eyes of supporters? I don't know why he needed redeeming. Second, what position and character of player do you think NYCFC needs? Presumably, I think he means with that open DP spot.
Yeah, well, Sam, you and I talked about this before the show. I think they're probably going to be looking for another midfield player. You know, maybe somebody who can step into the central midfield, kind of deeper in midfield, and be more of a dominant presence there. I think they have Keaton Parks there. They have some options in central midfield, but I don't think they have like a really dominant personality if we're talking about character of player, somebody who can kind of impose themselves on the game in one way or another. You know, maybe that's a guy who is more of a deep lying playmaker. More likely in my mind, it's somebody who's kind of more of a destroyer who can influence a game with how much ground they cover and the types of tackles they get into. You know, the way Diego Chara has for Portland Timbers, you know, the way Ozzie Alonso did for Seattle Sounders, I could see that type of signing being prioritized for NYCFC. What about you?
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to go for like a pure six like that, because they just signed Alfredo Morales. They have James Sands, who I think they project as a midfielder. He's played center back as well, obviously, for them. I think maybe a number eight. You know, you mentioned Keaton Parks. He's done, I think, well for them, but I think that they probably could upgrade there. Santiago Rodriguez, he kind of looks like he might be, I don't know if they see him as more of a winger or as more of a 10. He's played both in Uruguay. So I kind of get the feeling maybe he could be the replacement for Maxi Morales, who is getting older and, you know, dealing with injuries pretty significantly. I also don't, you know, I don't know exactly what the situation is with their contracts up top. I don't know how long Eber is under contract for. Tati Castellanos obviously just signed a new deal, but, you know, he's made no secret that he wants to be eventually move to Europe or maybe Brazil and go to a different club. So I think he's one that they think they can sell. He's at a good age. So, you know, if you're going to, if Eber's out of contract, or if Castellanos is maybe looking at a move, then maybe you go and sign another number nine. So I don't know. I think NYCFC has a lot of good pieces on their roster. I think they're a strong team, and I'm very curious to see what these new guys do. And we haven't really seen any of them yet, but I'm very curious to see what they do. They're very young in most cases, so we'll see if they have the instant impact that some of the older DPs have. But Talismagno in particular, big talent. So we'll see how he performs in MLS. And with that, we have our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you for the questions. Hopefully you enjoyed our answers somewhat. It's been fun. I'm off to look for Clint Dempsey, and I think Paul is off to stuff his face with dairy products in Wisconsin. So we'll be back next week. Thank you for listening. This has been Allocation Disorder.